Welcome, folks. Welcome to this episode of the Law of Self-Defense show. I am, of course, attorney Andrew Branca for the Law of Self-Defense. Thank you so very much for being here. So usually we talk about use of force law here, the use of force to defend yourself, defend your property, your family, to defend other people. But every once in a while, we talk about Second Amendment issues. Although I don't consider myself a Second Amendment lawyer, my area of expertise is really confined to use of force law. But we're blessed here in America to have available to us, for the most part, not everywhere, unfortunately, but for the most part, the single most effective means of defending yourself against lethal attack, firearms. I know you own them. I own them for reasons of personal protection, sport, hunting, lots of reasons to own guns. And of course, since 2008, we've had a series of U.S. Supreme Court decisions affirming that the Second Amendment is an individual right, that the constraints of the Second Amendment apply to the states as well as to the federal government, that law-abiding American citizens have a constitutional right to keep and bear arms, meaning carry arms in public, and so forth. Heller, McDonald, Caetano, Bruin, I've read all those cases into shows for the Law of Self-Defense community. Recently, I was asked to read into the record a more historically distant case involving the Second Amendment, and that would be U.S. v. Miller from 1939. Now, Miller is today not a very useful Second Amendment case, partly because of Heller, McDonald, Caetano, Bruin, much more recent U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence on Miller. But there's a little-known history around Miller that I think all of you might find interesting. In effect, a governmental conspiracy to attack and constrain the Second Amendment. Sound crazy? Well, we're going to learn all about that because back in 2008, a very interesting law review article was written titled "The Peculiar Story of United States v. Miller." If you're a law self-defense member, I'm going to embed this into the blog post version of today's show. Written by attorney Brian Fry. And attorney Fry has a very interesting take and insight on the history surrounding the U.S. v. Miller decision. Now, in a separate show, I am going to read into a show the U.S. Supreme Court decision of U.S. v. Miller, but I thought I would first read this law review article about U.S. v. Miller to provide context for when you do get to the Miller decision itself. Today's show is sponsored by the Law of Self-Defense, specifically our advanced live online class taking place on April 20th, 2024. This is our full day course on use of force law that makes you hard to convict if you're ever compelled to use force in defense of yourself, your family, or your property. We cover everything you need to know, why and how the legal system prosecutes self-defense, the five elements of self-defense, the fundamental building blocks of any claim of self-defense. We cover defense of others and defense of property, consciousness of guilt, self-defense immunity. We spend almost an hour talking about interacting with the police in the aftermath of a use of force event, how to craft your own customized, legally sound self-defense strategy, and much, much more. Now, we only teach this class twice a year at most. So if you miss this April course, it'll be at least 6 months before you have the opportunity to take this course again and make yourself hard to convict. Do you know when you're going to be attacked? It's not up to you. The bad guy chooses the time, place, and manner of attack. You need to be ready for both the physical fight and the legal fight before that happens. And register now, and you can get up to 50% off for this April 20th Law of Self-Defense live online advanced course. Don't hesitate. Scan that QR code now or simply visit lawofselfdefense.com/advanced. Let's do a brief overview of what Miller was and what Miller had held. So we have here United States v. Miller. The appellants were Jack Miller and Frank Layton. These happen to be two kind of deadbeat bank robbers that got pulled over by police and found to have an unregistered illegal short-barreled shotgun. The decision is from 1939. It was a unanimous decision of the Supreme Court. The facts of the case were that an Arkansas federal district court charged Jack Miller and Frank Layton with violating the National Firearms Act of 1934. So the NFA was only a few years old, brand new, really, when this happened, when they transported a sawed-off double-barrel 12-gauge shotgun in interstate commerce. Miller and Layton argued that the NFA violated their Second Amendment rights to keep and bear arms, and the district court, that's the federal trial court, agreed that the NFA violated the Second Amendment. Smart decision. And the trial court dismissed the case. But the state appealed, and the appeal went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the question before the U.S. Supreme Court was, does the Second Amendment protect an individual's right to keep and bear a sawed-off double-barrel shotgun? And the conclusion by the U.S. Supreme Court was that the purpose of the Second Amendment was to maintain effective militias, effective state militias. Congress could require registration of a 12-gauge sawed-off shotgun if carried across state lines. Now, again, this is obviously not sound U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence, probably not at the time, but certainly not now, in the context of the much more recent Bruin, McDonald, Caetano, and, sorry, Heller, McDonald, Caetano, and Bruin decisions. So the result was that the Supreme Court reversed the trial court, holding that the Second Amendment does not guarantee an individual right to keep and bear a sawed-off double-barrel shotgun. Writing for the unanimous court, Justice James Clark McReynolds, that's not a name familiar to anybody, is it? It didn't do much good work. Reason that because possessing a sawed-off double-barrel shotgun does not have a reasonable relationship to the preservation or efficiency of a well-regulated militia, the Second Amendment does not protect the possession of such an instrument. So, to translate this, what this Supreme Court decision of Miller is saying is that the only weapons protected by the Second Amendment would be weapons useful to a militia. In fact, the gun controllers now have taken the completely opposite view, by arguing that things like an AR-15 for all the assault weapons bans, for example, an AR-15 is not protected by the Second Amendment because it is suitable as a weapon of war. Interesting how the tables turn. So this is the formal description of U.S. v. Miller, the generally accepted description. Now I'd like to take a look at the history around this, brought to us by Attorney Brian L. Fry. Now, I want to make very clear, this is not my scholarly research. All I'm doing is reading Brian's work, Brian's Law Review article from 2008. Full kudos to him. We're blessed to have fair-minded legal scholars willing to do this kind of work. So the peculiar story of United States v. Miller, let's dive into it. On April 18, 1938, the Arkansas and Oklahoma State Police stopped Jack Miller and Frank Layton, two washed-up Oklahoma bank robbers. Miller and Layton had an unregistered sawed-off shotgun, so the police arrested them for violating the National Firearms Act, the NFA. Surprisingly, the district court, that's the federal trial court, dismissed the charges, holding the NFA violates the Second Amendment. Good going, trial judge, I agree. The Supreme Court reversed in United States v. Miller, holding the Second Amendment does not guarantee the right to keep and bear a sawed-off shotgun as a matter of law. 70 years later, this article is published in 2008, 70 years later, Miller remains the only Supreme Court opinion construing the Second Amendment, meaning defining the boundaries of the Second Amendment. Obviously, other Supreme Court decisions had mentioned the Second Amendment in passing, but this was the only Supreme Court decision that was really attempting to define the boundaries of the Second Amendment. By the way, this Law Review article was published in 2008. When did Heller occur? D.C. versus Heller? 2008. So poor Brian wrote here, Brian Fry, attorney Brian Fry, wrote here that 70 years later, Miller remains the only Supreme Court opinion construing the Second Amendment. And months later, there was the second U.S. Supreme Court decision construing the Second Amendment, D.C. versus Heller, which I've read into a Law of Self-Defense show before. By the way, if any of you go to lawofselfdefense.com/2A, the number 2 and the letter A, it'll pull up an aggregation page where all my shows focusing on the Second Amendment can be read, and they're all open access. That's lawofselfdefense.com/2A, number two, letter A. So 70 years later, Miller remains the only Supreme Court opinion construing the Second Amendment, but courts struggle to decipher its holding. Some find Miller adopted an individual right theory of the Second Amendment. Some find it adopted a collective right theory, and some found it adopted a hybrid theory, protecting the right to possess a firearm in connection with militia service. Most recently, in Parker v. District of Columbia, the D.C. Circuit Court concluded Miller assumed the Second Amendment protects an individual right to possess and use weapons of the kind in common use at the time, including handguns. And this is what the U.S. Supreme Court would end up holding in later decisions like Heller, McDonald, Catano, and Bruin. Continuing with the Law Review article of Attorney Fry, oddly, Second Amendment scholars have largely ignored Miller. While individual and collective right theorists alike claim Miller supports their position, most provide only perfunctory account of the case. So for clarification, obviously an individual right under the Second Amendment means each and every individual has a personal right to keep and bear arms. The collective right argues that the right to keep and bear arms is in a militia, a collective militia, not in the individuals within society. Of course, current U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence defines the Second Amendment as individual right. Most provide only a perfunctory account of the case. The few exceptions focus on the text of the opinion rather than the history of the case and the context in which it was decided. All conclude Miller is an impenetrable mess. Bad facts tend to make bad law, folks. This essay suggests the conventional wisdom is only half right, because Miller did less than generally supposed. Part one of this Law Review article presents a brief historiography of Miller. It argues scholars have not provided an entirely convincing account of the Supreme Court's holding in Miller, largely because they focus on the original meaning of the Second Amendment. Part two of this Law Review article recounts the history of the case. It shows Jack Miller was a career criminal and government informant. It finds Miller was a Second Amendment test case arranged by the government and designed to support the constitutionality of federal gun control. And part three of this Law Review article analyzes Miller in light of this history. This essay concludes that Miller is coherent, but largely irrelevant to the contemporary debate over the meaning of the Second Amendment. Miller was a Second Amendment test case teed up with a nominal defendant by a district judge, trial judge, sympathetic to New Deal gun control measures. New Deal, of course, being the political ambitions of Franklin Delano Roosevelt back in the day. But the Supreme Court issued a surprisingly narrow decision. Essentially, it held that the Second Amendment permits Congress to tax firearms used by criminals. While dicta suggests the Second Amendment guarantees an individual right to possess and use a weapon suitable for militia service, dicta are not precedent. So dicta, folks, are things that might be said in a court opinion that are not essential to the core finding of the opinion. They're kind of conversational side roads. The opinion would still be internally coherent, even if the dicta had been left out. So because dicta is not key to the ultimate finding of the decision, it's deemed not to have precedential value, not to be controlling authority on later decisions or other courts. Continuing with the article. In other words, Miller did not adopt a theory of the Second Amendment guarantee because it did not need one. Part one of this Law Review article, the historiography of United States v. Miller. Originally, courts and commentators alike found Miller inscrutable, or maybe just unremarkable. In any case, they basically ignored it. In 1939, legal scholars were uninterested in anachronisms like the right to keep and bear arms. But as gun control became increasingly controversial, scholars began to debate the meaning of the Second Amendment and the nature of the right to keep and bear arms. Eventually, they produced remarkably sophisticated and comprehensive competing accounts of its origins and ratification. Second Amendment scholarship reflects the bitterly partisan politics of gun control. Opponents of gun control generally endorse an individual right theory, claiming the Second Amendment protects an individual right to possess and use firearms. Advocates of gun control generally endorse a collective right theory, claiming it protects a collective right to form a militia. Both theories find substantial support in the text and history of the Second Amendment. Unusually for Second Amendment scholars, text and history are everything. Individual and collective right theorists alike focus on the original meaning of the Second Amendment, carefully parsing its origins, drafting, ratification, and implementation in the early republic. Indeed, originalism uniquely dominates Second Amendment scholarship. Why? Maybe the focus on originalism is tactical. Maybe it is strategic. Collective right theorists in particular may find originalist arguments less embarrassing than the alternatives. Second Amendment scholarship does highlight the Talmudic niceties of constitutional law. Why is this right different from every other right? And maybe the focus on originalism is just circumstantial. After all, without clear precedents, what is left but original meaning? Regardless, courts are obliged to follow Miller as far as it goes, whatever the Second Amendment originally meant. Of course, both individual and collective right theorists still claim Miller supports their position. Individual right theorists generally emphasize that the court addressed the merits of Miller's Second Amendment claim rather than dismissing it for lack of standing. Some go further and argue Miller simply failed to show short-barreled shotguns have military uses. Collective right theorists highlight the court's conclusion the Second Amendment must be interpreted and applied with the end of preserving the militia in view, and argue the Second Amendment simply protects the right to serve in the militia. Many note the absurd consequences of holding the Second Amendment protects only military firearms rather than those actually used by civilians. In the end, it's a stalemate. On its face, Miller does not clearly adopt either theory of the Second Amendment. Part 2 of the Law Review article, The History of United States v. Miller. Jackson Miller and the O'Malley Gang. Jackson Jack Miller was a gambler, roadhouse owner, and small-time hood from Claremore, Oklahoma. Born in about 1900, he grew into a hulking 240-pound thug. By 1921, he was in trouble with the law. His troubles worsened on August 14, 1924, when he accidentally killed H.A. Seacrest, a young court reporter from Tulsa, while working as a bouncer at the Oak Cliff Resort near Claremore. Seacrest, the court reporter, was plastered and roughing up his date, so Miller decked him, breaking his jaw. Unfortunately, Seacrest died of septicemia a couple of weeks later. Miller turned himself in on September 11, 1924, and immediately posted $5,000 bail. But Miller did not hit the major leagues until he joined the O'Malley Gang in 1934. The Depression was the golden age of Midwestern bank robbery, and the O'Malleys executed some of the era's most daring and successful heists. From 1932 to 1935, they claimed most of the major bank robberies in the Southwest, hitting banks in Missouri, Arkansas, Kansas, and Illinois. Originally known as the Ozark Mountain Boys, the gang consisted of a score of hoods, most of whom met in the Missouri State Penitentiary. A reporter christened them the O'Malley Gang after the dashing Leo Irish O'Malley, notorious for his sensational but remarkably inept kidnapping of August Luhr. In fact, O'Malley was only a bit player. The gang's real leaders were Dewey Gilmore, Daniel Dapper Dan Heady, and George Leonard Shock Short. In the summer of 1934, Short moved to a rented farmhouse outside of Claymore. The rest of the gang soon followed. Heady recruited Miller as a follow-up man, a lookout, and wheelman, a getaway driver. Then the O'Malleys got to work. On September 14, 1934, they hit the McElroy Bank and Trust in downtown Fayetteville, the oldest bank in Arkansas. While Miller and Art Austin circled the block, Gilmore, Heady, Virgil Red Melton, and Fred Reese broke into the bank before it opened, shanghaied the employees as they arrived, and made off with about $5,700. That's the equivalent of about almost $90,000 in 2007 dollars. Then on December 22nd, 1934, the O'Malleys robbed two Oklahoma, Oklahoma banks at the same time. One of the few successful double heists in American history. They drove a Plymouth and a Ford into Oklahoma at dawn, wore bandages concealing their faces, and struck shortly before the banks opened. Gilmore, O'Malley, Short, and Russell Land Cooper hit the Oklahoma National Bank, while Heady, Melton, and Reese hit the First National Bank of Oklahoma. Miller was stationed at the Oklahoma city limits to guard against possible breakdowns and to pick up members of the gang if their autos failed. Armed with pistols and machine guns, the O'Malleys bound and gagged the unsuspecting bank employees as they arrived, then forced a bank officer to open the safe. The Oklahoma National Bank yielded $13,186, and the First National Bank of Oklahoma yielded $5,491.25. Let's see. Yep. No translation of that into modern money. The police pursued to no avail. Miller returned to Claremore with his $2,100 share of the Oklahoma job, half of which he kicked back to Gilmore on the sly. But he soon grew restless. On the night of January 11th, 1935, he and some friends decided to rob Joe Lewis's gas station and cafe in Salina, Oklahoma. 19-year-old Percy Ballinger was alone behind the counter when Miller, Ernest Tennyson, Ray Anderson, Norman Hawk, Howard Bridewell, Cap Ellis, Bill Myers, and Blue Culver sauntered in at about 2 a.m. They ordered coffee and started playing the slot machines. When they got unruly and started tilting the machines, Ballinger asked them to leave. The Hoods returned a few hours later, accompanied by Jeff Armstrong, who promptly pistol-whipped Ballinger. They stole $23.71 from the till and $120 from four slot machines, which they dumped in Lake Cherokee. A week later, the police arrested the whole crew in Claremore. It was the beginning of the end for the O'Malleys. On May 3rd, 1935, the O'Malleys hit the City National Bank of Fort Smith, Arkansas, stealing about $22,000. It was their last big job. The police arrested Cooper as a likely suspect and struck gold. Cooper ratted out Gilmore, who was already on the lam. The police caught up with Gilmore on May 22nd outside of Lancaster, Texas. Gilmore sang too, fingerprinting the rest of the gang. The police pinched O'Malley and Heady in Kansas City, where they'd rented a swanky pad from James Maroon. O'Malley immediately confessed to the Lure kidnapping and was extradited to Illinois. But the FBI took Heady to Muskogee, Oklahoma, to face federal charges on the Oklahoma job. A couple of weeks later, the police nabbed Short in Galena, Missouri. And on August 8th, they caught up with Melton and Reese at a fishing camp in Taney County, Missouri. The FBI took all three men to Muskogee for trial. In the meantime, federal prosecutors indicted the O'Malleys in the Eastern District of Oklahoma. The Oklahoma trial came first. Federal prosecutors charged Gilmore, Cooper, O'Malley, and Short with robbing the Oklahoma National Bank and Heady, Melton, and Reese with robbing the National Bank of Oklahoma. All seven pleaded not guilty, and the trial was set for October 16th. But on October 2nd, the United States reindicted the lot of them, added Jack Miller to both counts, and postponed the trial to November 25th. Miller soon flipped, confessing to his role in the Oklahoma job and turning state's evidence. Miller was the government's ace in the hole. To preserve the surprise, federal prosecutors sequestered him in the county jail until trial. As soon as the trial began, Miller's lawyer, H. Tom Knight, announced, "Jack Miller, my client, will testify only on condition that he be granted complete immunity." Judge Robert L. Williams agreed on the condition Miller gives a complete and truthful account of the crime. He did, and then some. Miller, placed on the witness stand, identified the defendants as co-conspirators and testified Dan Heady, charged with participation in the robbery of the First National Bank, approached him regarding robbery of some banks. He testified the plan of robbing the Oklahoma banks was agreed upon, and he was employed as a follow-up man. He said he received $2,100 as his share of the loot taken from the banks. Miller's erstwhile companions branded him a squealer. Cooper even requested to leave the courtroom while Miller testified. The trial was over almost as soon as it started. On November 22nd, the jury convicted the seven defendants on all counts. Williams acquitted Miller, as promised, but added an admonishment. Quote, "You had a narrow escape this time, and you won't be so lucky again. Get into something honest and quit this gambling business." Close quote. Miller immediately returned to Claremore. Williams set a sentencing date of December 9th, 1935, but on December 3rd, Hetty's wife, Pretty Betty, slipped him a pistol during a visit. Hetty used the pistol to break out of prison, escaping with Gilmore, Short, and Cooper, among others. During the jailbreak, Hetty shot Muskogee Chief of Detectives Ben Bolton, who died a couple of days later. A huge posse of Oklahoma police and federal agents, aided by bloodhounds and observers in airplanes, tracked the fugitive to Pushmataha County in the Kaimichi Mountains near Clayton, Oklahoma. On December 5th, the posse caught Cooper while he was walking down a country road 12 miles north of Clayton. And the next day, they found Hetty and Gilmore in a farmhouse near Weathers, Oklahoma. When Hetty and Gilmore refused to surrender, the police opened fire, killing Hetty. Gilmore quickly gave up and led the police to Short, about a mile and a half away. Short was already dying, having been critically burned in an accidental fire the night before, and he drowned when a boat used to evacuate him accidentally capsized. On December 9th, Williams sentenced Gilmore, Cooper, O'Malley, Melton, and Reese to 25 years. Miller was terrified of the fugitive O'Malley's, so the FBI held him in a county jail during the manhunt. They needed their snitch alive for the Arkansas trial. On January 10th, 1936, federal prosecutors charged Dewey, Gilmore, Russell Cooper, Otto Jackson, and Floyd Henderson with robbing the McElroy Bank and Trust Company of Fayetteville and the City National Bank of Fort Smith, Arkansas. At first, all four pleaded not guilty, but Gilmore flipped when Miller implicated him in the Fayetteville job, and the others quickly folded. On January 14th, Judge Hiram Hartstill Ragon sentenced Gilmore, Cooper, and Jackson to 25 years and Smith to 12. And on February 14th, Gilmore and Cooper got another 99 years for murdering Bolton. That was the end of the O'Malley's. Melton, Cooper, Gilmore, and Reese started in Leavenworth and ended up in Alcatraz. O'Malley did his time in Illinois, but soon went mad and died in 1944. And Miller returned to his petty ante ways. In 1937, the United States Fidelity and Guarantee Company sued him for the proceeds of the Okama job, to little effect. Eventually, he fell in with Frank Layton, another small-time Claremore hood. On April 18, 1938, the Arkansas and Oklahoma State Police stopped Miller and Layton outside of Siloam Springs, Arkansas, en route from Claremore. They had an unregistered short-barreled shotgun in the car and apparently were making preparation for armed robbery. So the police arrested them. Part B, Miller in the district court. That's the federal trial court. Miller and Layton ended up in Fort Smith, Arkansas, where United States Attorney for the Western District of Arkansas, Clinton R. Barry, charged them with violating the National Firearms Act. Barry knew all about Miller as he had attended the O'Malley trials and seen Miller testify. Barry was eager to ensure the government could prove an NFA violation. It is, quote, extremely important this case be investigated by competent federal officers quickly before these parties released on bond to prove possession of this weapon in Oklahoma immediately before arrest in Arkansas to show transportation, close quote. The United States Attorney's Office forwarded Barry's request to the FBI for investigation. Miller was scheduled to appear before the district court in Fort Smith during its next term, which began June 6, 1938. While in prison, Miller returned to form, ratting out Joel Carson for murdering a hospital security guard in Little Rock, Arkansas. On May 3, 1938, District Judge for the Western District of Arkansas, Hiram Hartstill Ragon, set Miller's bail at $2,000. Which D.A. Blackburn of Clarksville, Arkansas, posted on May 16th, 1938. You hear that, folks? So the federal trial judge set Miller's bail at $2,000. And guess who set that bail? The district attorney posted Miller's bail. Why would that be done? Why would a DA post the bail of a career criminal? Continuing now with the article. On June 2nd, 1938, Miller and Layton were both indicted on one count of violating 26 U.S.C. 1132C by transporting an untaxed short-barreled shotgun in interstate commerce. Both Miller and Layton pleaded guilty. But the trial judge, federal trial judge Ragone, refused to accept their plea and appointed Paul Guttenson as counsel. On June 11, 1938, Miller and Layton demurred to the indictment, claiming that it presented insufficient evidence of a transfer requiring payment of a tax and challenging the constitutionality of the National Firearms Act under the Second and Tenth Amendments. Surprisingly, federal trial judge Ragone immediately issued a memorandum opinion sustaining the demurrer and quashing the indictment. He held that the National Firearms Act violates the Second Amendment by prohibiting the transportation of unregistered covered firearms in interstate commerce. Why did he do that? Why did this judge make this decision? Because he wanted it to be appealed. He was providing an opportunity for an appellate court, ultimately, of course, the Supreme Court, to make a Second Amendment ruling reversing him and affirming that the government could tax firearms under the NFA and not have that be an infringement of the Second Amendment. In other words, this federal trial judge was himself a gun controlist. Continuing now with the decision, with the article. United States v. Miller immediately became the first Second Amendment test case in American history. On September 21st, 1938, Miller and Layton were both reindicted on one count of violating 26 U.S.C. 1132J for transporting an unregistered short-barreled shotgun in interstate commerce. Instead of a transfer, now it's a transport. On January 3rd, 1939, Miller and Layton demurred again, claiming the NFA registration and taxation provisions violate the Second Amendment, as they do. Federal trial judge Ragone immediately reissued the same memorandum opinion. Miller and Layton were free men and promptly disappeared. The next day, Governor Bailey appointed Guttenson to finish the term of State Senator Fred Armstrong, who had died on December 10th, 1938. The appointment sparked a political firestorm. Section C, National Firearms Act. Enacted in 1934, the National Firearms Act taxed the manufacture, sale, and transfer of short-barreled rifles and shotguns, machine guns, and silencers, required registration of covered firearms, and prohibited interstate transportation of unregistered covered firearms. Nominally, it was a revenue act, levying a $200 transfer tax on all covered firearms, as well as an annual license tax of $200 on dealers, $300 on pawnbrokers, and $500 on manufacturers. In practice, it produced little revenue because it imposed prohibitive rates, often many times the value of the covered firearms. Of course, the NFA was really a ban, disguised as a tax, intended to discourage the possession and use of covered firearms. Quote, "The gangster as a law violator must be deprived of his most dangerous weapon, the machine gun," close quote. Modeled on the Harrison Narcotics Act, the NFA made covered firearms risky and expensive. Quote, "We certainly don't expect gangsters to come forward to register their weapons and be fingerprinted, and a $200 tax is frankly prohibitive to private citizens," close quote. The act was quite successful. While many people registered NFA firearms, few legitimate dealers could afford to pay the license tax, and even fewer legitimate buyers were willing to pay the transfer tax. For example, Oklahoma police saw dealers search for ways to get rid of NFA firearms. The Tommy gun era was soon over. The NFA was a product of a long-standing push toward federal regulation of firearms. In 1927, Congress prohibited mailing most handguns with limited success. Several bills introduced in 1930 would have prohibited the transportation of certain firearms in interstate commerce, but Attorney General Homer Cummings supported the NFA because it relied primarily on the tax power, ensuring its constitutionality. As originally proposed, the NFA also applied to pistols and levied a $1,000 tax on manufacturers and importers. However, after the NRA and other firearms associations opposed the inclusion of pistols at the public hearings, the restrictions on pistols were eliminated. The Ways and Means Committee approved the bill without reservation, and the Finance Committee recommended amending the tax on manufacturers and importers to $500, which the House accepted. Congress explicitly disclaimed any intention to include pistols and revolvers and sporting arms because, quote, there is justification for permitting the citizen to keep a pistol or revolver for his own protection without any restriction, close quote. Some gun control opponents suggested that the NFA was, quote, sponsored by people who wish to compel all sportsmen to register their firearms and store them in armories when they are not being used for hunting or target purposes, close quote. But even they generally conceded the Second Amendment permits federal regulation of machine guns and other gangster weapons. Quote, no person outside our national defense units and police has any legal use for such weapons because they have no sporting or hunting value, being made for the sole purpose of taking human life, close quote. So the gun controllers have been using this blood will run in the streets language forever. But Cummings was not content with the NFA. The New York Times reported that he considered federal regulation of pistols, quote, the national government's next step in the war against crime, close quote. So in 1936, he circulated a proposed bill imposing a $1 transfer tax on pistols and requiring registration. The gradual expansion of federal gun control met with growing opposition. Thousands of gun owners wrote to the Ways and Means Committee objecting to the Federal Firearms Act, some invoking the Second Amendment. Nevertheless, on June 30th, 1938, Congress passed the Federal Firearms Act, regulating interstate commerce in firearms. Part D, Federal Trial Judge Ragone. The newspapers assumed Miller was a test case of the National Firearms Act. They were probably right. The government needed a Supreme Court precedent holding that federal gun control does not violate the Second Amendment. Federal Trial Judge Ragone teed up the case. Ragone did not really think the NFA violated the Second Amendment and probably colluded with the government to create the ideal test case. His opinion is peculiar on its face, begging for an appeal. A memorandum disposition is appropriate when deciding a routine case, but not when holding a law facially unconstitutional. And Federal Trial Judge Ragone was the first judge to hold that a federal law violates the Second Amendment, even disagreeing with a federal district court that had dismissed a Second Amendment challenge to the NFA. Before he became a judge, Federal Trial Judge Ragone represented the 5th District of Arkansas in Congress from 1923 to 1933. As a congressman, he was a vocal advocate of federal gun control. In 1924, Ragone introduced an unsuccessful bill prohibiting the importation of guns in violation of state law and vigorously supported another bill prohibiting the mailing of most pistols, which eventually passed in 1927. Basically, Ragone wanted to prohibit firearms used by criminals, including pistols. Quote, I want to say that I am unequivocally opposed to pistols in any connection whatever. If you want something in the home for defense, there is the shotgun and the rifle. But a pistol is primarily for the purpose of killing somebody, close quote. And he specifically dismissed Second Amendment objections to the federal gun control. Quote, I cannot see that violence to the Constitution, which my friend from Texas sees in the bill, close quote. If Arkansas could prohibit pistols, so could the United States. A prominent Democrat, Ragone, endorsed Roosevelt in 1932. That would be Franklin D. Roosevelt, and helped push the New Deal through the Ways and Means Committee. In return, Roosevelt made him a federal trial judge. The NFA was part of Roosevelt's New Deal program, enacted with broad support shortly after Regan took the bench. But the Federal Firearms Act of 1938 was stirring up popular opposition, much of it based on the Second Amendment. The government needed to silence the complaints, and Miller was the perfect vehicle. Regan had presided in an O'Malley prosecution, so he knew Miller was a crooked, pliable snitch who wouldn't cause any trouble. And Gutensohn was a comer who knew the game and got his due. Regan's memorandum opinion presented no facts and no argument. With no defense muddying the waters, it was the government's ideal test case. All right, folks, so we're about 45 minutes into this, and I'm halfway through. So rather than read this in 1 hour and a half long show, I'm going to stop here as a part one, and I'll record a part two, and I'll put the link to the part two in the description of this particular show. And of course, I'll do the reverse once I have the part two done. So with that said, for the moment, I will bid you all adieu. Remember, if you carry a gun so you're hard to kill, that's why I carry a gun. It's why I carry a knife. It's why I carry pepper spray. It's why I study jiu-jitsu, so that I'm hard to kill, so my family is hard to kill. Well, then you also owe it to yourself and your family to make sure you know the law, so you're hard to convict as well. Until part two, I remain Attorney Andrew Branca for the Law of Self-Defense. Stay safe.